You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. And before we start the show today, we're going to hear just a few words from our sponsors. The Radio Cafe is brought to you in part by Total Wine and More. With their new location in Santa Fe, they can enhance your summer dinners, barbecues, and brunch parties. They make it easy with their famous in-store tasting bar. For example, you can taste a delicious Oak Ridge Zinfandel, and for summertime brunch, there's the Rondell Gold Brut Cava, which is such a good sparkling wine for mimosas. Total Wine and More has a location in Albuquerque, and their new Santa Fe store is on Zafirano. You can go to totalwine.com for in-store pickup, too. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off your next $50 purchase. And thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. And if you've been looking to go solar in your home, Santa Fe County's Sustainability Office wants you to know that the 30% federal tax incentives are only available until the end of 2019. So if you've been thinking about going solar, now's the time to do it. If you're not sure where to start, start with Santa Fe County's Office of Sustainability, where you can get a free, impartial consultation to help demystify the process and help you calculate upfront just how big a system you might need. You can contact them at 992-9832 or visit santafecountynm.gov/public_works. And by the way, if you want to sponsor the Radio Cafe, you can contact Henry Lopez. His email is hlopez@sfnewmexican.com. You can also call 505-986-3054, or you can go to radiocafe.org and click on New Mexican and find all that information there. And now to our program. I'm happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Charlotte Rowe. She's a seismologist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. She's an adjunct professor at New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology and at the University of New Mexico. And we're here to talk about volcanoes, which have been in the news a lot lately because of what's going on in Hawaii. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, before we start talking about volcanoes, I wanted to ask you, what drew you to the study of volcanoes in the first place?
We can blame Santa Claus.
Do tell.
When I was in first or second grade, one Christmas morning, I came out, and as he is wont to do, Santa Claus left a bunch of stuff under the tree, and as the Santa that came to our house was wont to do, most of it was books. And there were two books under the tree that year. One of them was about the 79 AD eruption of Vesuvius and the destruction of Pompeii and the excavations that at that time were currently underway. This was back in the 1960s. And the other one was about a little Mexican boy named Pepe and his burro, and about how Pepe's father, who was a farmer, had a volcano erupt in the middle of his cornfield and grow up, and the volcano consumed their village. And these both captured my imagination.
Santa gave you two volcano books the same year?
Yes, he did. And some years later, I found out that they were both true stories. And that just did it for me. That was wow. And so I had a thing about volcanoes ever since. And when I went off to be a seismologist for the oil companies after getting my bachelor's degree, I kind of threw in the towel after a couple of years and ran off to Alaska to study volcanoes.
And so you decided to go sort of the more academic route, at least for a while?
I went through a master's degree and worked at the Volcano Observatory up there for many years. Eventually went back and finished my PhD at New Mexico Tech, still focusing on volcanoes and geothermal systems, and did a postdoc on volcanoes, and then I came here.
Have you ever have you ever been on an erupting volcano?
Actually, it used to be number one in my life's wish book. My wish was granted in 1980 when I was at Mount St. Helens. I was able to go up as a student assistant and work on the slopes of the volcano while it was doing its early eruption activity before the big explosion. We got ash on us and everything. It was very cool for me. But my thesis volcano when I was a graduate student was Mount Erebus in Antarctica, and it erupts several times a day. So on many occasions when I was standing on the top of Erebus, I got to observe eruptions there. And then when I was in Italy a few years ago, I was visiting the volcano observatory there, and the lead volcanologist took us up to the top of Mount Etna, and it was doing, you know, a few little steam emissions now and then, and we actually climbed all the way up to the rim of what was the southeast crater, and my colleagues had gone over to look at something else, and I was still standing on the edge of the crater, and there was this big explosion of steam and ash, and I got this ash cloud that washed over me, and you can't run away from it. So I just closed my mouth, closed my eyes, plugged my nose, and waited. And I got covered with ash, and I had ash in my teeth and ash in my ears, and I could smell the sulfur gas and everything, and it was burning my nose a little bit. And the ash cloud cleared away, and I just thought that was the neatest thing since sliced bread. And on the same trip, I got to climb up to the top of Stromboli Volcano, which is an island volcano in the Aeolian Sea near Sicily. And went all the way to the top. Stromboli, like Erebus, erupts many, many, many times a day. And they actually let tourists go up to the top of the volcano. They have these concrete bunkers around the summit, so in case it does something particularly energetic, you can go and hide in a bunker until it's done. But you can stand on the edge of the crater and look down into these multiple vents that are glowing, and there's lava that kind of fountains out of it. And you stay after sunset, and the sun goes down and it gets dark, and then the incandescent red is just spectacular against the black. So those were both a dream come true for me.
So let's talk about just a really basic question. What is a volcano?
A volcano is an edifice on the surface of the planet. It could be a mound, it could be a mountain, it could be a crater. It's a place where material from deeper inside the earth comes up onto the surface.
Now, there's a kind of geological reality going on under the crust of the earth, mm-hmm. which contains a lot of hot stuff that comes out when a volcano erupts.
Yes.
How deep down is that molten layer?
Most of the melt that we see comes from no deeper than the bottom of the Earth's crust, and often it can be shallower. You know, in school, you probably were taught that the Earth is divided up in cross-section to crust, mantle, and core. And most of that is mantle, and then the crust is a very thin veneer around the outside. And the mantle is very hot, but it's also under a tremendous amount of pressure. So it's not liquid. It tends to flow. You could think of like slowly stretching some silly putty or something like that. And at the bottom of the crust, there is a layer that has an anomalously high temperature because that's where most of the natural radioactive elements are concentrated, and they emit heat. It's a little bit of a crapshoot where you're going to, you know, in theory, it would be kind of random, except we have particular geographic areas where we see these phenomena and they're localized.
So what is it about those geographic areas that make it more likely for a volcano to be there in the first place and then to erupt?
Well, you've heard of the Rim of Fire, and that's sort of the ring around the Pacific Ocean. And that's where a lot of our volcanoes on land occur, is around the Ring of Fire. Those are places largely where we have the crustal plates are moving together. They're bumping into each other, and one of them ends up being forced underneath another one. And this one that was out on the surface and it was nice and cool, it gets forced under another one and it bends and starts to go back down into the Earth's mantle. Eventually it reaches a point where, because of the chemistry of the rocks, it will start to melt. And that melt can make its way, it doesn't always make its way to the surface, but it can make its way to the surface, and if it does, you get a volcano. And this explains a lot of the volcanism that we see around the rim of the Pacific.
Now, are these just as likely to be under the ocean as on land?
There are seamounts on the ocean floor, which are submarine volcanoes. I don't know of any off the top of my head that would be a result of subduction. Because
subduction was that process you
just
described?
Yes, where it's subducted beneath another slab.
Okay.
This collision of the plates where one goes under the other. I suppose that's possible. I know that there are seamounts that are associated with places where plates are pulling apart. And as we have these convection cells that move around, you could view them as sort of dragging the crust along with them. And so as there are places that come together, there are places that are pulling apart. And we can see a beautiful pull-apart area, the Mid-Pacific Rise and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, where there's volcanism and the plates are moving apart from each other and new lava is coming up and plastering on either side and pushing it apart. It's very interesting, but those are not the ones that we tend to worry about from a societal perspective.
Right, right. So when lava comes up down at the bottom of the ocean is not particularly warm. I mean, it's mm-hmm. cold at depth. Does the lava just solidify? And I mean, does anything happen? Do whales get bent out of shape?
It's so deep down there that the pressure of the overlying water column, we call that the hydrostatic pressure, that tends to contain any sort of explosive activity. There are some vents that have more energetic bubbling up of some of the gases. I think they call those smokers. And there's been some really interesting science in ocean biology where they found whole collections of ecosystems and life forms that live around these smokers where the water is warmer than the deep, cold, regular ocean water. Things called tube worms are the ones that I can think of, but there are other species as well that are associated with these vents.
Amazing.
It's fantastic.
I mean, the ability of life to just adapt to almost anything.
Yeah.
So is there any predictable pattern? And of course, we are, as you say, most worried about and interested in volcanoes that erupt in places where there are people and ecosystems and things that affect our own mm-hmm. lives. Is there any predictable pattern to eruptions?
Well, you can look at the eruptive history of any particular volcano, and you can say, oh, okay, you know, this volcano, since recorded history, which may be only a few hundred years in that
right.
location or less. Gee, in the last 100 years, it seems to have erupted 5 times. So we might expect it to go off about every 20 years. That's kind of a statistical game. And so you can kind of forecast and you can say, it wouldn't surprise me if, well, it's been 18 years. So in the next couple of years, we might see something going on at this volcano. That's not a prediction per se. The long-term prediction is not something that I think we can do. In the shorter term, and I'm talking about maybe a year or two, certainly when you get up to a few weeks, if we have instrumentation on the volcano, then we are very good at observing unrest, seeing changes, and starting to pay a lot more attention to what's going on.
So that time frame is a few weeks. In other words, if you've got instruments monitoring volcanoes that are potentially active, there is something that happens a few weeks before they erupt that your sensors can tell you, okay, there's a danger here?
Yeah, sometimes the window is longer, although with many of the volcanic eruptions that are still being evaluated today, they're seeing all of these precursors with 20/20 hindsight.
Right.
The primary tool that has traditionally been used to monitor volcanic activity instrumentally is seismology. And seismology is actually a very young science, maybe 120 years since the first seismographs were starting to be deployed around the world, and they were not looking at volcanoes, they were looking at earthquakes.
Are the two related?
In a sense, yes. In a large sense, both of the phenomena have to do with tectonic movement with changes in the stresses and the stress fields in the crustal plates as they move around. The earthquakes that we think of, like the big California earthquakes, the even bigger Alaska earthquakes, the Sumatra earthquake, those events are not directly related to volcanism per se. Those have to do with those plates that are sticking against each other as they're trying to, one is trying to either subduct beneath another or slip, and they build up a whole lot of stress and then finally they fail. Now, a large earthquake can trigger activity at volcanic and geothermal fields if they were teetering on the brink already, because the shock waves from the earthquake can perturb the local stress system just enough if it was about ready to go. after one of the large Alaska earthquakes, for instance, we saw Long Valley, California, light up like a Christmas tree with lots of little tiny micro earthquakes. It has an active geothermal field, and that's a very common thing for it to do. And large earthquakes can trigger that. Volcanoes tend not to be responsible for large earthquakes. The size of an earthquake is related to the surface area of a fault that broke to produce the earthquake. And so if you have an area of a fault, for instance, the 1964 Great Alaska earthquake was a magnitude 9.2. And the area that ruptured where the two plates were pushing against each other was 900 kilometers long and about 400 kilometers wide. So that's a huge amount of surface area, which resulted in a very large earthquake. Now, how big is the biggest volcano? We've got the Jemez volcano in our backyard, and the crater on that is, what, about 20 miles across. Okay, you compare that to 900 by 600. You know, it's much smaller. The volcano is not going to produce a large earthquake. We do, however, see lots of small earthquakes associated with volcanic systems, and we can observe changes in that activity, which kind of gets our attention, and we sit up and we start paying more attention when we start to see elevations in the small earthquakes associated with a volcano.
We're going to take just a quick break right now to hear from our sponsors. The Radio Cafe is brought to you today by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. After a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies but very little moisture, the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. Visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. That's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And thanks to the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. And we also want to let you know that the Radio Cafe is brought to you today by Morningstar Senior Living, which is building its newest community on Pacheco Street in Santa Fe. They'll be providing independent living, assisted living, and memory care to make sure that you and your loved ones can live fully and vibrantly in a safe environment. You can reach Morningstar Senior Living at 505-919-7989. That's 505-919-7989. Or go to morningstarseniorliving.com and let them know that you heard about it on the Radio Cafe. And now back to our program. Let's talk about the Hawaii volcano Kilauea. Describe to us, from this geophysics perspective, what happened.
It has been actually erupting for about 35 years. This is part of an ongoing eruption. I can remember back in the mid-80s seeing the reports where the volcano went into this phase of cyclic eruptive activity, where it would go through these cycles where the volcano would start to inflate. They measure that with things called tilt meters to look at how the volcanic edifice is changing. And the tilt would go up and up and up and up and up. And then it would kind of suddenly deflate and you'd get an emission of magma. And so obviously, to the casual observer, what's happening is the magma is pushing up inside. It's causing some degree of inflation, not necessarily just the magma itself, but there's also pressure from the gases. There's the fluids. There's the whole hydrothermal system associated with the volcano. And all of that is pushing up on the edifice of the volcano. And then it finds a way to get out and escape, either by a lava flow or a lava fountain or something. And all that pressure is relieved, and the volcano kind of goes back to its previous position. And this went on over and over and over again. Things change, and a volcanic system is very complicated. There's a zone of weakness that extends from the Halemaumau crater towards the east, towards the eastern end of the island, and it's called the Southeast Rift Zone. That rift zone has experienced some spectacular episodes of eruption and lava fountaining in these long curtains in the past. There's some beautiful photographs of these. There was a big episode in the 1950s and I believe in the 1920s as well. What happens there is typically Kilauea kind of has its magma chamber underneath, and it's got a magma column leading up to the crater and some sort of pooling of the lava in the lake. And the difference between magma and lava is that lava is what we call it after it comes out of the ground.
So it's the same thing.
It's the same thing. It's just whether it's underground still or it's come out. So it's got a lake of lava that sometimes rises, sometimes falls a little bit, depending on changes in the gas pressure coming up from below. And this whole process, you know, that lava is very hot, and so it can erode the sides of the crater a little bit. It can do a little bit of melting on the walls, either at the top or down below in the magma chamber. And like any liquid, it's going to try and find a way to move if there's something driving it, like pressure of gas. And there is a zone of weakness off towards the east where this magma, every now and then, manages to escape. And it leaves the summit area and it kind of heads off down towards that east rift zone. Sometimes it gets stuck, it stalls, and the thing just chills in place. Sometimes it has enough momentum behind it that it will start moving along, and as it continues to find zones of weakness, sometimes that zone of weakness is to go up to the surface and fountain around up there or run out in a lava flow. And when it does that, typically you don't see it forcing its way further east through the rocks because it's much easier to just go through that opening.
What is the cause? I mean, we've seen these fissures that are so sort of primal, you know, like the earth opens up to swallow you kind of thing. You see these gaps in the earth that are going over roads and under people's houses and so on. What is the cause of those?
A lot of that is just tensile failure in the overlying rocks. As the magma pushes its way underneath, there's also it's exerting upward pressure on the overlying ground and soil, and that upward pressure is going to cause it to dome up a little bit, and so you're going to get cracks that open up.
And is there lava that comes out of those fissures?
Often. Not always. Some of it is simply cracks in the pavement or cracks in the soil, soil failure, maybe a little bit of landsliding in some places. But some of these cracks do end up being weak enough that it's the favored path for the lava and gas to escape.
Now there's these, I've seen pictures, as probably everybody has, of these blue flames that are associated with these. And it reminded me of that moment in Game of Thrones where one of the dragons gets zombified by the White Walkers and he's spewing blue flame instead of yellow flame.
I've never seen that show.
Oh, well. What's
I don't have a TV.
Good for you. I saw the whole thing. But anyway, what's the cause of the blue color?
That is actually methane. My understanding, I saw a little blurb about that on one of the updates that the Volcano Observatory was issuing, and it's methane gas that's just coming up through the cracks in the road. I think it's from decaying biological material near the surface.
Are there greenhouse gas and climate change implications of volcanic eruptions?
The sum total of volcanic input into the atmosphere is dwarfed by anthropogenic input. Volcanoes do put out a lot of CO2, H2S, SO2. The primary gas that comes out is water. There is a little blip that is a contribution from a large eruption, which this is not yet a large eruption, and it may not turn into one. But it is absolutely dwarfed. It's some orders of magnitude less than the annual anthropogenic contribution. For a very, very large volcanic eruption of a supervolcano, there is some historic evidence that it can put so much ash into the upper atmosphere and the stratosphere that for a couple of years it will cool things. It's like a nuclear winter. There's so much particulates up there that it blocks the sunlight. And there's, you can't quote me on which volcano, I think it was sometime in the 1500s, there was a volcano that had a major eruption somewhere in Indonesia, I believe. And there are temperature records and observational records in Europe of what essentially was kind of the equivalent of a nuclear winter.
Very interesting. What are the chemical and physical effects when hot lava hits the ocean? I mean, we talked a little bit about when there's an eruption deep in the ocean, but in a case like this, in a place like Hawaii, you might have lava coming up from a volcano and then going into the sea. Mm-hmm. What happens?
Well, you get a lot of water flashing to steam. And, you know, there's no confining pressure at the surface beyond one atmosphere. So it can flash to steam. It can be very energetic. Sometimes it will carry some of that lava with it in terms of very hot fragments of ash and volcanic glass. So you don't want to be really close to one of those.
Because if you breathe it, who knows what's going into your lungs?
Right. Hot molten glass. It's probably chilled by the time it's going to get into your lungs. But it's still a lot of broken fragments of silica. They're very sharp and pointy, and you don't want to breathe that. You don't want to be near one of these steam explosions because it can hurt you. And steam is hot, and steam burns, as we know, are pretty nasty.
You've just talked about some potential health dangers, like breathing glass is not good for you. Mm-hmm. What are some other potential human health effects of volcanic eruptions?
Well, they're the gases. The rotten egg-smelling gas, which is hydrogen sulfide, that is not healthy to breathe. In very small quantities, it's unlikely to kill. You know, if you kind of detect it and smell it, it's like, okay, well, this tells me that there's some of this around, and so I should probably mosey on out of here. But it can be concentrated in larger concentrations in some places, and that's definitely a health hazard. A lot of volcanoes around the world have been known to produce pools of carbon dioxide. And there's some very famous examples of people who have been killed because they have walked into low-lying areas of ground or gone down into their basements in some cases. And CO2 is colorless, it's odorless, you don't know that it's there. It's a little bit heavier than general atmosphere, so it's going to pool in these low places. And if you walk down into an area, you may not come out.
Because you don't have enough oxygen?
Right. So you're asphyxiated. It doesn't poison you so much as you don't have any oxygen, so you become asphyxiated.
Wow.
There are places in Iceland where, of course, you know, plants like CO2. So low-lying valleys where the grass is just unbelievably green and the plants are unbelievably healthy and the sheep that went there are not.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that was another question that I had was, what kinds of wildlife are the best survivors of volcanoes, and which ones are the most vulnerable?
It really depends on the volcano. A volcano like Kilauea, the lava, in terms of lava flows, it moves pretty slowly. You can step out of the way of most lava flows.
So there are presumably mammals running away from it?
Yes, and unless they happen to get caught right in an eruption plume, the birds can fly away, bugs can fly away. I imagine that right in the locus where lava flow is coming into the ocean, it's not very good for the local fish. They probably have already left the area, though, because it's not all of a sudden there's all this lava. It starts as a trickle and it pours more and more, and so they're going to have enough sense to kind of get out of the way. I think that the volcanoes like Vesuvius, Pinatubo, St. Helens are going to have a much more devastating effect in very short order on local wildlife that hasn't already left the area, because there are hot clouds of gas with ash entrained in them that can go roaring down the sides of these mountains, and they travel at hundreds of miles an hour. And you've seen the pictures of Mount St. Helens where they just mowed all the trees down and stripped all the topsoil off, and anything that's in their way, just like the ruins at Pompeii, are not going to have a good survival chance. There's a very famous eruption that happened in the Caribbean on the island of Martinique in 1902. Mont Pelee erupted, and the entire city of Saint-Pierre, which was downslope of the volcano, one night there was one of these glowing clouds, and it was named in French as Nuit Ardente because of Mont Pelee. It came roaring down the side of the volcano, kind of skipped over a ridge that a lot of people thought would stop any flow from going that way, overran the city, and more than 20,000 people died in just minutes.
Wow.
As a result of this. So they are very dangerous.
There's something that's so primal about volcanoes and about that kind of destruction. I mean, they seem to be like a metaphor for the death force. I mean, a whole living ecosystem, mm-hmm. could just be overrun by darkness, like literal and figurative fire and then darkness.
There's a lot of legends that go around volcanoes. There's a lot of mythology surrounding volcanoes. We all have heard of the goddess Pele, of course, and she's the goddess that governs Kilauea, and a lot of the locals in Hawaii believe that someone has angered Pele, and she's doing her thing right now. But they also tend to be kind of fatalistic about it. This volcano is doing what it does. The reason that we are so particularly concerned right now is because people built their houses in places where the lava happens to be coming out. We tend to fly airplanes over it, so now we have to worry about the ash that goes up and could bring down an airplane. But this volcano has been doing its thing for many, 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 many years. And I think our presence there is what makes it a concern. And to think that it's going to stop just because we built a house is a little silly.
Well, and we have spent, for better and worse, so much of the last kind of five centuries dominating nature.
Yes.
And that's something you can't dominate.
No, you cannot. There have been some efforts with mixed success, but some have been successful, to divert lava flows. They did this very famously in Iceland. There was a lava flow that was threatening a village, and they got out there with the boats that are for putting out fires on ships, so they have these fire hoses that suck up seawater, and they were actually able to chill the front of the lava flow so that it built up this rampart of lava, and the rest of the lava kind of turned and went another direction. So there are some things that we can do to tweak the outcome in a more favorable direction, and sometimes it might work. But by and large, yeah, the volcano, we're not going to stop it.
Yeah, that's like on the level of the action movies where they go out and blow up the asteroid that's going to hit the Earth kind of thing. You were at Los Alamos where the atomic bomb was invented. How does the destructive force of a volcano compare to that of, like, say, a Hiroshima-level atomic bomb? I mean, I was looking at, there are both photographs and then artistic depictions from before photography mm-hmm. of volcanoes, and the plumes that come out of them look almost like mushroom clouds. How do they compare?
I can't give you a one-to-one numerical, a quantitative answer, because I haven't actually looked at this, but there are scientists at Los Alamos who have gone out and looked at the effects of nuclear explosions and compared those effects to the effects that have been observed on buildings and people and infrastructure and animals to well-documented volcanic eruptions. And there was a really interesting conference where a whole section of the conference was devoted to what can we learn about the blast zone for this dangerous volcano. This was particularly talking about Vesuvius at the time, and how what we observe there can be kind of back projected onto the effects we would expect from a nuclear explosion, and vice versa. When they were doing above ground nuclear tests, they would go out and they would put up buildings and infrastructure and things and go out and actually look at the effects of the blast on these things. And this data was actually then turned around and used to help inform some of the public safety ruminations and considerations in cities that are on volcanoes, to say, you know, what can we expect? What sort of devastation? How can we get people out? How safe are they if they just hide inside versus should they leave? So it was a really interesting comparison, but I can't really quantify it because I did not do these studies.
Are there any national security dimensions to the study of volcanoes?
It depends on how you define national security. Our water is a national security issue. Therefore, a large volcano that's a threat to a major city, or a threat to a major water supply, or a threat to our power transmission or something like that, or to our aviation industry, can be considered a national security concern. For instance, when everything was grounded in Europe, when that Iceland volcano was going off because no airplanes could fly, that could be a national security concern. When I was working in Alaska, monitoring the volcanoes there, one of our customers was the military, because there are several Air Force bases up there and they needed to be able to fly their planes. So they relied upon us to tell them that we thought that this volcano might provide a problem and they should probably move the squadron to a different Air Force base so they're not grounded. So from that perspective, there are some national security concerns. Also, there's sort of a feedback loop between the research that we do for national security issues in seismology and the research that volcanologists do for volcano monitoring. Some of the tools that they use are useful for us. Some of the tools that we develop can actually be applied to earthquake and volcano monitoring and earth modeling and things for their purposes as well. So there is the opportunity for cross-pollination.
So, for example, the tools used to monitor volcanoes and earthquakes could also be used to monitor nuclear testing, to see whether somebody is detonating something, that kind of thing?
We use a lot of the same principles in our science. It's all seismology. And also there's acoustic and infrasound, which is part of volcano monitoring. It's also part of nuclear explosion monitoring. We tend to look at things at a different scale because we're looking for things that may have happened half a world away, whereas a volcano is just not that big. But a lot of the same techniques and a lot of the new methods that scientists are always developing to try and get more out of their data, those kinds of things are useful for the earthquake and volcano researcher, just like they're useful for somebody who's looking for man-made explosions.
Tell us about New Mexico's volcanic history.
Well, of course, we have a very big volcano in our backyard in Los Alamos, the Valles Caldera, part of the Jemez Volcanic Complex. It's one of the three what you could call supervolcano complexes in North America, the other two being Yellowstone and Long Valley, California. Its major caldera-forming eruption that produced the thick layers of what we call the bandolier tuff, those beautiful layers that you can see as you're driving up to Los Alamos, that occurred between 1.4 and 1.1 million years ago. And when that occurred, the crater kind of dropped down a little bit, producing this caldera that we have today. After that major caldera-forming eruption, there have been a number of eruptions since then, which have been smaller. They've been largely confined to the crater, and they've been what we call effusive rather than explosive. And they produce those domes that we see when we're driving across the crater floor headed towards Jemez Springs, the most recent of which is about 40,000 years old. We do know that there's still a lot of heat down there. We've got the whole geothermal thing going on. There's all the hot springs. There have been some scientific studies, geophysical studies, looking at gravity, looking at seismic, trying to image what's down there. We have seen an area of slow seismic waves down there, which tends to be associated with hot material. Whether it's molten or not, we're not really sure. But we don't believe that it's an extinct volcano. And the whole center of the state is kind of bisected by a thing we call the Rio Grande Rift, which is a place where the Earth's crust is slowly being pulled apart. And as it's pulled apart, the crust in between kind of tends to drop down a little bit. So the Rio Grande Rift, which is magnificently evident in Albuquerque, you can see the Sandias are essentially the eastern wall of that rift. The western wall of the rift is not as clearly defined. There's a number of sort of parallel little faults, which we can't see all of them at the surface. But along any rift area, you have the opportunity for some mantle material to come up and for there to be localized volcanism. There's those five volcanoes west of Albuquerque out on the West Mesa, just south of Socorro. In fact, Socorro Peak is volcanic. There's some beautiful lava flows south of Socorro where we see this very interesting changes in the lava chemistry as you're driving along. So it's tectonically active, but not as much, say, as Alaska or the Cascades.
On the North American continent, what are the locations that are most likely to experience a major volcanic eruption?
A major volcanic eruption. With the caveat that although St. Helens was impressive, volcanologists considered it a very small eruption.
Really?
Yes. The volume of material erupted out was less than 1 cubic kilometer, whereas the eruptions that produced the Jemez and the Valle Grande were something, several hundred cubic kilometers of material.
A cubic kilometer of lava is a lot.
It is.
It's a lot of lava if you're living there.
And when you expand it out and you puff it up like pumice and you turn it into ash, then it turns into a tremendous amount of stuff flying out of the volcano and falling down. This volcano, there's evidence of its ash into Kansas. The Jemez has the potential to have more eruptions. Nobody considers it particularly likely that there'll be these big cataclysmic caldera-forming type eruptions again. Long Valley, California is one that they're watching very closely. There's absolutely no evidence that something major is imminent, but it's clearly active. So They've got all kinds of instrumentation on it. They're keeping an eye on it. And they're keeping an eye on Yellowstone as well. Again, there's no indication that anything is imminent. The activity ebbs and flows. Every now and then you get swarms of events. And then a lot of the media, they go, you know, oh my gosh, it's going to erupt. But no, it's doing its normal thing. Volcanoes breathe and they shift and they just have periods of where their behavior evolves, but that doesn't mean that they're about to blow. So we don't think that anything is imminent at any of these major volcanoes, but certainly Yellowstone is very active visibly with all the geysers and everything, and Long Valley is active, and there are some thermal anomalies that they pick up now and then, and they do see periods where it might inflate and deflate occasionally. So they're keeping an eye on it.
The eruption of the volcano Kilauea in Hawaii, it's just really captured the imagination of so many people, and it's fascinating and it's scary. How do you see people reacting to it? What can we learn from it? How are children responding to it?
I think children are fascinated. I think adults are fascinated. I have people come up to me and just start talking about, oh, this is so cool. Or they might first say, oh, isn't this scary? Is Hawaii going to get exploded off the map? And it's like, well, take a look at the map. Look at the island and look at how small these lava flows are. And they're stopped in this little corner. I think it's particularly scary for the people who live in those subdivisions. But I think it's a real opportunity to light a fire under people who want to know more and who are interested in the natural world. And this, especially in the schools, you know, teachers can go online and find so much footage, even real-time updates and pictures and explanations that the USGS and other volcano sites are putting out, that they can leverage this in the classroom to first capture the kids' attention and then use them either to teach a little bit of math, you know, calculate the rate that the lava is moving down, teach a little bit about geology or rocks. They can even use it to teach societal and ethnic things like about the Hawaiian culture and who is this goddess Pele that they believe in, and that, you know, where does Hawaiian culture come from? Oh, this is part of the Polynesian culture. Where is Hawaii? You can teach geography. You could say, where are the other active volcanoes in the world? Do they look like this one? Do they behave like this? So it's a really great and exciting chance when you've caught their attention to impart some of that excitement and learning.
And out there somewhere in this country or in radio land, there's going to be some six-year-olds who...
They'll be volcanologists when they grow up.
They'll be volcanologists,
yes.
Like you. If people are interested, whether they're 6 years old or any age, and they want to find out more and start sort of following what's going on in volcano world, what should they do?
Very good lead-in. They could Google Volcano World. There's a website there that points to volcanoes all around the world, and it gives historic information on each of them. I think that for current information, at least about U.S. volcanoes, if they would Google USGS volcanoes.
USGS stands for U.S. Geological Survey.
Yes, and the U.S. Geological Survey operates 5 volcano observatories in the country. If you go to their website, they'll point you to all these observatories. You can look at all the volcanoes they're monitoring, and you can actually click on a link. You can subscribe so that you actually get the official updates for the current activity at any volcano that you choose. And they also have some wonderful links that will take you to maps and videos of the current activity. And so it's a wonderful opportunity to sit at your computer and wallow in volcanoes and learn a lot about them.
Excellent. Charlotte Rowe is a seismologist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.